This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. I think it's important, ladies and gentlemen.
God.
At times in your life, to examine long-held beliefs. I'm Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is my annoying partner in crime, Nick Duke. We are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Yeah, I'm annoying Nick Duke today because Greg is sleepy, and so he's just wanting to mope his way through this podcast, and I am not here to allow it. I'm not going to allow it. He needs to wake his ass up and give you, the dedicated listener, the quality effort which you have come to expect and demand from the hard-traveling fanboys. And one of us here is trying to bring that energy level, and the other one is trying to Eeyore his way through this podcast, and I'm just not going to allow it.
Yes, Nick. One of us is in a bit of a funeral dirge type of mood anyway, because you see, Nick, I have had to examine one of my long-held beliefs in the last 24 hours. It was something I've been dreading, because sometimes, and you know how this is, you doggedly stick to points, even to the point of irrationality, and beat them into the ground until the ground no longer exists beneath your feet. So you know how it goes.
Now, what the hell are you talking about?
Belief that's a fundamental part of your core. That's a fundamental part of your being,
right?
That defines you and your character that you portray to others. And one of those things to me has always been the fact that, for the better part of, how long has it been since this movie came out? 17 years.
Are we going to introduce what we're doing for this week's podcast?
No, we're not going to introduce what we're doing. I have held the belief that Willem Dafoe's performance in the 2002 film Spider-Man by Sam Raimi, the topic of today's podcast, which is called Off the Page, and is focused on the 2002 film Spider-Man as part of Spider Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, located in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in the L-shaped studio.
God, I hope I get to correct. I hope I get
motherfucking Canada.
I hope I get numerous opportunities to correct you on things throughout this podcast, because it's clear you're going to take it super well.
Anyway. The point that I'm making here is that in the course of the 17 years since this film, the topic of our show, has come out, my opinion has been that Willem Dafoe put in a god-awful, terrible performance as the Green Goblin that hurts the film. Even though it was an enjoyable film, I've always thought that. I've always liked the film. I've always thought it was a good movie. But I've always thought his performance was too over the top, too hammy, too Vince McMahon like to succeed.
And
to
you're saying that is you just used Vince McMahon like as a negative term. I cannot believe it.
Well, at the time, you have to understand, at the time it seemed, oh, I don't want to see somebody coming out there and saying life sucks and then you die in a comic book movie. You know, I wanted to see some nuance, some you know, Daniel Day-Lewis emoting, if you will. Well, as I have found out in the last 24 hours, Nick, things change. Things change over the course of time. We evolve. Our viewpoints evolve. Our feelings about the world change and morph as we morph into our adult bodies. And our stomachs become larger, and our breasts become larger, and our genitalia becomes smaller somehow. I don't know. It just seemed like a thing to say. Anyway. So, and I came to realize that what I did want in a movie is Vince McMahon. That what I did want is a villainous Norman Osborn who chews the scenery, not just chews the scenery, but completely consumes the scenery in every scene that he's in. I realize that's a good thing. that that's what I want because it adds to the entertainment value on the screen and it makes you believe that character. So, folks, we are here to talk about Sam Raimi's Spider-Man as part of Spider Month. And this has been something that we've talked about doing for a while. Nick has been looking forward to it because he has believed at his core that a rewatch of this film in 2019 with my current tastes in pop culture would reveal that my longstanding viewpoint of Willem Dafoe's performance was mistaken.
Yep. And as per usual on this show, I was right.
Not so. Not so with the per usual, but is so in this particular situation. And so with that being said, folks, gosh, we've had a hell of a week here at Hard Traveling Studios. It's been busy. It's been, time-consuming, a lot of stuff going on, a lot of events packed into a few days. Work, of course, is happening. And here we are, yet still, giving you just the best content you could possibly ask for free. For free! $0, Nick. Nobody has to pay to listen to our dulcet tones.
They don't. They don't have to pay a dime. All they owe us is their extra time.
That's right. That's a good a segue as any. So what we like to do here with Off the Page, as you know, if you're a longtime listener of the show, we will watch the film or the topic of this podcast. In this case, it is a film. And we will give the people a chance at home, if you are for some reason listening to this podcast at your home or at your workplace, and your workplace actually allows you to watch movies at work, which would be cool. You can get your copy of this movie, the DVD, Blu-ray. I don't think it's streaming anywhere, but get your copy of this film. Fire it up. We've got ours paused right now at the 0 minutes and 0 seconds segment. I am watching, Nick, the widescreen DVD of Spider-Man in my PlayStation 4 console.
I think I'm watching the full screen, DVD of Spider-Man.
Oh my! How is that on a current generation television?
I mean, it's just a matter of whether you prefer your boxes on the side or on the top. When I had a box TV, I always wanted full screen.
Same.
Because I didn't like having the letterbox and stuff because my TV was so small that I wanted every inch of a picture. And now a lot of my full screen DVDs, as you would imagine, don't age well.
I'm the same way. Almost every DVD in my collection to a point is full screen because I preferred that on the old box TVs. I was the same way as you, Nick. But now, luckily, this widescreen DVD, it actually fits to the screen perfectly. So it's pretty good. And the PS4 has this cool upscaler in it that upscales to 1080p. And it actually works pretty damn well on this DVD. It ended up looking very good, the screen quality. So had no issues there. What about you? Did you have any issues adjusting to watching a DVD versus our usual Blu-ray content?
I got to be honest. I watched this at like 4 in the morning this morning. So through blurry eyes and, I didn't notice any picture stuff, but maybe I'll notice it here with a more energetic view.
Yes, and certainly I have an energetic view as well for this movie tonight, Nick. So with that being said, folks, I'm going to count you in. We're going to hit the play button in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Play.
And there she is. There's the Columbia lady.
Yep, there she is. Red hair and all. Is that the same? Never mind. I'm not going to use the Outsiders line.
Never mind. There, it did pop up a Sony Pictures Entertainment Company.
Yep, Sony Pictures. I believe a Bryan Singer joint is coming up behind this. No. Is this the debut of this Marvel logo here, or was this in the first X-Men movie too? I can't remember.
I do not know. Honestly, I would think it would probably have been in the first X-Men movie, but. I certainly can't speak to that with any certainty. So, but one thing, much like the X-Men films that I figured we'd bring up here, these Raimi Spider-Man films have excellent opening credit sequences.
It's kind of something that's gone out of vogue, I guess you would say, in the superhero.
Really, in movie making in general. Like, I can't remember the last film I saw with an opening credit sequence. It's been some time, so.
It's kind of faded out the same way that trailers have faded out the third-person narrator approach.
Mm-hmm.
Trailers, you know?
Right, right.
Like, in a world where, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, but this is awesome. This was, I remember, because we talked about this.
Later films, they will use this, and they'll put, like, images inside the webs or whatever to, like, recap mm-hmm. the events. So, like, Spider-Man 2 recaps the events of Spider-Man 1 in the opening credits, and Spider-Man 3 recaps both Spider-Man 1 and 2 in the opening credits.
Yeah, it's kind of a clever way to freshen up the audience on things that they'll need to keep in mind for this upcoming movie.
Now, granted, this one just has webs, so no...
Certainly, yeah, that's for the future. There's nothing you need to know going into this movie. It does not... This movie, unlike some other ones that will come later, does not presuppose any knowledge of the characters.
So, I'm sure that I knew that Danny Elfman did the music for this, by the way, prior to rewatching it, but I had forgotten until I rewatched it this morning. And, like, instantly upon hearing the music, I was like, oh, that's mm-hmm. gotta be Danny Elfman. It's just so,
and the music,
so distinct.
The music stands out.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, I was the same way, Nick, because it didn't matter to me if I did know it in 2002. I wouldn't have cared. I was 18 years old when this movie came out, so I would not have cared who did the music at that time. But now, looking back on it, I can hear it. It sounds like a Danny Elfman score, and it works so well. Like, it's one of my favorite parts of the movie, honestly, because it really sets the scene and sets the mood throughout the film so well. And there are moments in this movie, by the way, that do remind me a little bit of Burton's Batman at times. Even especially the boardroom scene that we'll talk about later sort of reminds me of the scene in Burton's Batman where the Joker kind of shall we say tries to take over Gotham's crime.
A lot of the
world.
Interior of the Osborne home reminds me of Burton's Batman in terms of, like, kind of this ostentatious design they go with for it that reminds me a little bit of their very specific Burton take on Wayne Manor.
Indeed. I probably,
I'll tell you one thing that doesn't hold up. Man, these subtitles are pixelated as hell. It literally looks like a 16-bit series of subtitles have popped up on my screen now.
Oh, Satan's Revenge. It's already happened. I talked about the to you off-air, Nick, about the touchiness of the PS4 controller as a movie watching.
Don't touch it. How about that?
Device. Well, I was trying to turn on my goddamn subtitles, Nick. And I can't get them on. They won't work, is what I'm getting at.
You have to. Yeah, I could. They wouldn't work on mine either. You had to open them up from the disk menu. So.
Yep. There you go.
In any event,
I'm not going to have any subtitles then. So, but who needs them, really?
Who does?
So, Spider-Man is a character that you would think. Of all the Marvel characters, of all the comic book characters, after Superman, after Batman, probably the most famous comic book superhero. Fair to say?
Yeah, I would say so. I think at varying points throughout comic book history, other characters have kind of risen up, whether it be Wolverine or Iron Man now or whoever else. But I think Spider-Man has traditionally been at you know, in that top five and usually in that number three spot.
Joe Manganiello
is easily the most recognizable Marvel hero, I think is what we would say.
Yes. In this scene, Joe Manganiello looks not unlike a young Dave Bautista. shrunken down, of course. This is good stuff, man. I could only explain, Nick, the relation that one has to Peter Parker. In this film, how many times did I do that stupid thing where I think somebody's waving at me?
I did think of you when I watched that scene this morning. I was like, "That's such a Greg thing."
Totally a me thing. It happened. It's not even one of those like would probably happen. It did happen to me multiple times in life.
Now let's go ahead and address this up front. How do you feel about the hair that's being seen on screen?
Well, this is a big negative to the film. Let's be honest. I'm glad you brought that up, Nick, because that's the one thing that I noticed when I was watching this. Is like, you know, I like both of these performers here. You know, you got the Harry Osborn played by James Franco. I like him a lot. And then you've got Norman Osborn, who is played by Willem Dafoe, who I begrudgingly must admit I like a lot in this movie. We'll talk more about that later.
Why do you have to be so begrudging? Why can't you just give the man, eagerly give the man the props he deserves?
The one thing that I notice is they don't have basketball here. Now, I know that I know what many people out there are thinking. Many people out there are thinking, but Greg, they did not have the ability, the technology in 2002 to create basketball here. And you may be correct in that. I don't know. I'm no hairologist or stylist, if you will. However, I would argue that if you really want to be committed to the source material, I have another hot take regarding this later on in the movie, then I think you need to go the full Monty and work on James Franco and Willem Dafoe's hair, even against their protestations. So, you know, they're paying Willem Dafoe good money here, presumably, to play this role. Would you agree, Nick?
I would assume so.
He's a fairly in demand actor. So you're paying him good money. I would think that a part of that would be, it's only fair to say, you have to sit in your makeup chair and allow us to twist your hair and pull it and contort it into such a manner that it somewhat resembles the printed page.
What a dick. Flash Thompson.
Flash Thompson is not the nicest man in the world in this film.
And he's got his flunkies here.
Who are his flunkies, by the way? Do they even have names?
No.
Just turds.
No, I wish they
turds
did.
In the This guy looks like Sean William Scott, doesn't he? Look at him.
Where? At yeah, him. A little bit. Yeah, like a knockoff younger Sean William Scott. Because Sean William Scott had already aged a few years by this point. Hard living and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well.
And here's this teacher who is just a unique-looking individual.
The teacher looks about as invested in what he's doing as I am in what we're doing.
The teacher looks like he could be Joe Manganiello's little brother in this movie, by the way. Like, just, he looks like he's 12. How did he get a teaching degree?
Harry, one of the things that instantly endears me about this movie is Harry Osborn actually trying to stick up for Peter. So you get the impression of, because Harry is not a perfect person by any means. Harry does several things in this movie that are not good, but you also get the sense that Harry does have a good heart underneath all of it, because he does try to stick up for his friend when he's getting bullied, and he does, you know, you see why he and Peter would be friends, which I think sometimes when in some Spider-Man adaptations, they do not do a good job of establishing why Peter and Harry are friends, just that they are friends, if that makes sense.
It does.
And I'm not just singling out Amazing Spider-Man 2. It was also the animated series as
Amazing well. Spider-Man 2. They were friends for years. We just never knew about it until it was convenient. God almighty.
We're not here to talk about that movie.
No, we've already done our time on that one, and man, it was certainly a unique situation is the best way to put it.
No one's head is in a jar in this movie that I'm aware of. Although, who knows, really? So, Spider-Man, my point when I was first getting started with the Spider-Man discussion, the most popular Marvel character, you would think that there would have been a Spider-Man movie before 2002.
And they tried for many years. It was
20 years.
Yeah, yes. It was in development hell for a long time. I know James Cameron, I believe, had the rights at one point, was looking at doing it back in the 90s, and there were various scripts that went through. I know there was even a, if I remember, I read this the other day, there was a horror take on it that was bandied about at one point in the late 80s. There were all kinds of different low-budget, you know, attempts at putting this on the big screen, and eventually it wound up with Columbia Pictures and Sony, and made it to May of 2002 with the release. But if you remember, Greg, it was originally supposed to release, if I remember correctly, in December of 2001, and that first trailer had an action sequence set at the Twin Towers, and of course the events of 9/11 took place, and this movie wound up being pushed back 5 months and kind of inadvertently helped to create that early May tentpole now, which is kind of always occupied by a major comic book movie, Free Comic Book Day, kind of this comic book frenzy. So, weird series of events that led this to being released in May 2002, but here we are nonetheless.
Indeed, and so all these years of developmental hell kind of, and let's be honest, there's an interview with Stan Lee that I watched recently where from around this time where they're straight up that if not for the success of Bryan Singer's X-Men, this movie probably would not have happened, or certainly it would not have happened to the level that it did. One of the things that we'll find as we watch this film is that while some of the CGI and special effects don't hold up 17 years later. At the time, this was an incredibly groundbreaking film in terms of the effects and how all of the, people didn't understand at that time how they would possibly get Spider-Man in live action swinging through New York City. It was something that just didn't seem like they could pull it off and make it look good. Well, let's talk before we get into the crux of the film, as we'll have plenty of time to dissect some of these performances. And
oh, fuck this guy, by the way.
The general?
He's the worst.
General or Dr. Strom?
The general, not Dr. Strom.
Yeah, I felt bad for Dr. Strom.
That random board member, by the way, looks like he could have easily... It looks like they almost cast him as J. Jonah Jameson, and then they just found somebody better. And they didn't want to fire him, so they just let him do something else instead.
For some reason, he reminds me of one of the... a character you would see in the 60s Batman show. Not a villain, but like one of the like...
He looks a lot like the Alfred. If he had glasses on, he would look
like
the old
60s. Yeah, I can see that, yeah. Alfred. Yeah. But yeah, so let's talk about what an event this movie was.
Oh my God, yeah.
I still remember to this day, we did our X-Men review. It was a big deal to go and see X-Men at the theater, but it wasn't like this. Like this was,
right.
I distinctly remember this was a much bigger cultural type event than X-Men was. I think the promotion push was bigger for this movie, certainly. Absolutely. And we had been hyped for, like you said, they pushed the movie back. So there had been an extra, 5 months of hype behind this movie. And the anticipation going into it, all of us obviously would love the trailers and all that stuff. But
yeah, I was going to say the trailers for this were outstanding based on my memory. Because one difference immediately right off the bat that people noticed, Sam Raimi was bringing a little bit of a different visual flair to it than did Bryan Singer with X-Men. I mean, remember, we talk about the first X-Men movie, and while it's still a good movie, it is going out of its way at times to kind of hide its comic book roots. The costumes are all black. There's very little color. It's kind of trying to play it, as straight as it can. This, in the trailers, you're getting these bright red and blue colors. You've got the red and blue of Spider-Man. You've got the green of the Green Goblin. You've got these, very visually dynamic action set pieces that are being revealed in the trailer, and it just looked like it was going to have this energy to it that X-Men didn't have, even if X-Men is still a really good movie.
Certainly, and even down to, we talked about the casting in X-Men being really good, but even in this movie, the casting in the trailer just looked like it had jumped off of the comic book page, whether it was Mary Jane Watson, Kirsten Dunst, or whether it was Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker, whether it was Rosemary Harris as Aunt May.
The only problem with Rosemary Harris as Aunt May is that they couldn't find anyone who looked like she was 148 years old, because no actress is 148 years old.
No. It's no human being, in fact. Like, you'd have to go back to the biblical times and pull out one of those 189-year-old people or something to play the Steve Ditko Aunt May.
Yes, who is perpetually near death and just fragile as hell.
Whose face literally resembles a prune.
Yeah.
What would Aunt May, if Aunt May put her face into the that face app thing that people are using?
Oh God!
It would just be dust.
Yes.
Floating
in her hooch,
so to speak. So this was like a real cultural event when it came out. I remember my friends and I, we camped out at the theater. Not literally camped out. We didn't stay there overnight, but we got there real early. Like, we were in line for this movie for probably in the neighborhood of 2.5 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember, I saw it opening weekend on the Sunday, because I had friends that I attended church with at the time, and we kind of had a thing where a lot of times if all three of us were interested in a movie, we would go, just right after church to the first showing. And I remember this actually sold out like the 1 p.m. Sunday screening in Dothan, which in 2002, that was like unheard of in our area anyway. Like, you would occasionally get some Friday night sellouts or some Saturday sellouts. Sunday sellouts were extremely, extremely rare. And so we wound up not seeing this until like 4 o'clock that Sunday or something, because we had to just hang around outside the movie theater or near the movie theater, went to Barnes & Noble, or not Barnes & Noble, Books A Million and everything like that, because it was at the old Northside Cinemas back then. before we got to go see this. And I remember it was just exciting. And I'll tell you one of my most vivid memories, and it's a weird memory to have, but I have it nonetheless. They did a tie-in movie candy for this movie that was these red and blue sour gummy spiders that were freaking delicious. And I kept looking for them every Spider-Man movie that's come out since, and they have not remade them. But if anyone from the Sony marketing department is listening, I need some of those red and blue sour gummy spiders to come back. They were awesome.
Indeed so. And if you're also listening, anyone from Sony, we also want the original shooting script from Amazing Spider-Man 2 to be written out into a comic book so we can see what it would have looked like.
Or just made into a movie.
One thing before I get back to that. Well, this was one of the things that bugged me, weirdly enough, when I first saw the movie. Willem Dafoe, as Norman Osborn, has just taken the Green Goblin formula, what we will go to know as the Green Goblin formula, and instantly after drinking it, for no adequately explained reason, smashes the glass bottle into the ground, shattering it. Instead of handing it back to his associate, Dr. Strom, he shatters the thing, Nick. Why such wanton destruction?
To be someone's a showboat.
Someone's got to clean that glass up, though.
Yeah, but he's rich. Why does he have to worry about it? He ain't going to clean it up.
Now he's stroking out here.
It was an attempt to show Norman's...
flair for the dramatic.
It wasn't just the fact that he took the goblin serum. It was already in there. The goblin serum is just going to bring it out. And the way this is shot is so Sam Raimi at times, with like the quick cuts and stuff, and yeah, like the zoom ins and the facial reactions. It is very much, you know, you brought up the Tim Burton Batman, like not in terms of the two having similar visual styles, which they do at times, but when you watch either of Tim Burton's Batman movies, if you're familiar with the rest of his catalog, you can recognize you're watching a Tim Burton movie. Mm-hmm. And I think this, if you know any of the other Sam Raimi movies, you can instantly go, oh, this has Sam Raimi's like fingerprints all over it. The same thing as like watching the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, you know, like it Star Trek movie, but really, really feels like a J.J. Abrams movie.
Yes, absolutely. It is this is Sam Raimi's signature flair for how he puts his movies together. That scene, by the way, was terrifying. Even when I watched it last night, that shot where Norman wakes up from his coma, or from his being unconscious as seizure a result of the goblin former. That shot and how it's presented, it literally gave me a jump scare. I was like, ah! And I felt so bad for Dr. Strom in that scene.
It was the Norman, eyes, wasn't it?
Yeah, the eyes that just look insane. Reminded me a little bit of the bad guy from Chuck Norris's Silent Rage for a moment there. So
you are the only person who I've ever known to reference Chuck Norris's Silent Rage.
More people should reference it, though, Nick. It's one of the great unsung horror martial arts action films of the 80s.
Yes, there were many of those.
And a surprising amount. And that's just showing off. Good Lord. Contorting himself like that. Okay, first of all, another thing that just jogged in my memory, seeing that one of the memories I have of watching this opening night in the theater was all the girls squealing during that last scene of Peter waking up and suddenly he's ripped.
Does Uncle Ben just have an entire plate of eggs? Like, just a giant plate filled with eggs?
Yeah, the implication is he was going to die anyway, regardless.
He was eating a Gaston amount of eggs. That's a bit of a Disney reference for those of you out there.
He was going to die of cholesterol, high cholesterol, regardless of what happened with the gunman. That's one of the really, weirdly enough, one of those memories. I went on opening night, May 3rd, with a group of, gosh, there was probably six or seven of us that went and saw it together. We stood in line for 2.5 hours. We went in. The theater was raucous. It was loud. I remember that. This girl squealing for the scene, that scene, and then the rain kiss got squeals from the girls in the crowd. I remember that, and then
I hesitate to even. Well, we'll talk about it when we get there. If we get there,
so One of the many things that we that I remember was just the level of excitement. Remember when the movie ended? And there's always that. We talk about this on the show a lot. There's a recency bias whenever you see a movie, right? Where it's like, especially if it's one that you like, you tend to sort of like overrate it, if you will. There's no doubt about that. There's a natural tendency to feel like the most recent thing is the best or the worst or what have you. And so I remember my friends and I, when we were at the theater, we were like, damn, it doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, well, I was blown away. Like, I was This was 2002, so I was 14 when I saw it. And, like, it was – I thought that was the best comic book movie I'd ever seen when I first walked out of the theater, because I was like, God, how do you do one better than that? Like, I still had my love for things like the Burton Batmans and stuff, but I was like, that's on a whole other level in terms of dedication to – actually wanting to adapt a comic. Like, it was this whole other thing. So I don't know. I was blown away too.
Yeah. It felt like one of the first times that we had ever actually just seen the comic books that we grew up reading brought to life.
Right.
Because it wasn't Batman filtered through Hollywood or Superman filtered through Hollywood or at least the Superman probably was like that when it came out, but it was like a Superman of a different era, if that makes sense. When I would have seen that, it was 20 years hence.
We're about to get one of the major changes this movie made in the debut of the organic web shooters. And I'm sure we'll talk about that before, but go ahead and wrap up your point.
Yeah, so this was one of the first times that I can remember seeing like the comic books brought to life, or the cartoon. I had grown up watching the Spider-Man cartoon, and so to see so many elements of that cartoon and that story brought to life on the big screen is what kind of made this stand out. It was like, wow, we finally gotten one that feels close to the comics, that feels like we're watching a comic book movie as opposed to a movie about comic book characters, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does, yeah, and I would agree with that assessment.
So, yeah, here, we've gotten a lot already on this movie while we've been talking about the event aspect of it, but pretty straightforward and right out of the comics origin story here so far. You know, we've had, you know, Peter is a hard luck nerd that is a big science whiz. He loves – I love another thing about this movie, Nick. They establish his love of photography early on.
Mm-hmm.
He's a science whiz. He loves photography. He's good at it. And he's got a crush on the girl next door, in this case, Mary Jane Watson, and not Gwen Stacy, notably. And, you know, he's got Flash Thompson here, his bully at school. He lives with his Aunt May and Uncle Ben, and they're a kindly old couple. And just one of the things I also appreciated here, Nick, was the casting of Uncle Ben. He's great.
Yeah.
Still my preferred Uncle Ben of the two that we've gotten in live action.
Oh, no, I'm a Martin Sheen guy myself.
Interesting. I like this guy. I don't even know his name. What is this actor's name?
Oscar Robertson? No.
that's the famous basketball player.
It's something Robertson, right?
It is... Wikipedia is a big piece of shit. A big fat piece of shit.
It's so big.
What the hell? Okay, there, Cliff Robertson.
Cliff Robertson. Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Cliff Robertson.
Most notable for Charlie, I believe.
What is that?
You remember, I'm sure you remember, at some point in Alabama high school, you were forced to read an excerpt or perhaps the entire novel Flowers for Algernon.
Oh, yes, Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah, Charlie was the big screen adaptation of Flowers for Algernon, and Cliff Robertson played the titular or breastular Charlie.
Why does everybody get pissed off at Peter for fighting back? That's one thing I've never gotten.
That's a thing in pretty much every incarnation of the story I've seen done, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I just never quite get it. Like, what's he supposed to do?
Yeah. The Martin Sheen thing, though, to circle back around to that, you know, this version of Uncle Ben is very clearly like the more, you know, just kindly old man version. And as you know, I prefer the somewhat attitudinal, more personality driven version from the Ultimate Universe. And that's what I think Martin Sheen has a little bit more of that going on than than does Cliff Robertson.
And see, I liked his kind of attitude here, because like, it's not like he's a stick. He's not a stone like character. He's got emotion. It's just he is a nice guy, and he's a wise, kind of that wise old figure that, you know, the more of an old grandfather figure that I think is what kind of he reminds me of in this movie, is that the grandfather that has years of wisdom, and he's trying to deal with the fact that he's no longer relevant, you know, in terms of his skills. And so how is he going to deal with providing for a family, which that lays a lot of the seeds that we see play out in Spider-Man 2 of the money problems that come for the Parkers. So, yeah, no, good stuff there. But the sort of establishing you mentioned the organic web shooters as being a change. That's the first huge, other than the Mary Jane thing, Mary Jane being the love interest out of the gate. Instead of, now, this is a clear homage to Richard Donner's Superman, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
The Peter Parker running across the rooftops, kind of learning, learning how to use his newfound powers, and it looks just like the shot from Donner's Superman where Clark is running next to the train tracks. If you remember when he's testing out his speed, so. And this is a great scene too. I love this, the theater. I remember us laughing hard at this, and Shazam, yeah. As Peter tries to figure out how to make his web shooters go, and just can't get the hang of it. Mentioning things such as up, up, and away, Shazam, a few little cute nods to.
Do you like making the web shooters organic?
At the time, no. I didn't. I wish that they would have had him create web shooters like in the comics.
I still feel that way. It doesn't like bother me. Like, it's not a big deal, but it's just one of those things. I look at it, and I'm like, why not just have him make them? Because it always like helps to give the audience a visual reminder of just like how really smart he is. You know, that he's not just all brawn.
Yeah, and see, I think that I might have felt this way if this had been like most of the other Spider-Man movies that don't really focus on his science skills at all. Mm-hmm. But I think this movie does a good job having, you know, especially rewatching it, does a better job, honestly, than any of the other ones I think that I've seen of focusing on his science obsession. And maybe Spider-Man 2 does a little bit more, but
Amazing Spider-Man, he's working directly with Kurt Connors on the cure.
True.
Throughout the movie.
Very true. I've blocked out a lot of that movie, to be honest with you. I don't remember the great many details about it. I more remember two of those two movies. Gosh. Just because of the badness. But
and the recency, because we revisited it more recently.
Right. But I appreciate the fact that they remind us how smart Peter is. That he's constantly intrigued by matters of science and by anything that has to do with the sciences in general. But to that point, I would have preferred web shooters. I'm not sure the reason why they went with organic web shooters. I guess there's a line of thinking that it does make sense that part of spider powers would be the ability to generate webs. So I do kind of get that as well. It's not something that I was ever that hung up on. I remember first time I saw the movie, that was one minor nitpick that I had.
Right, but that's how I would describe it. It's still like a minor thing for me. It's not a huge deal. It also takes away like that classic Spider-Man trope of oh man, I'm out of web fluid.
Out of web fluid, yeah.
You know, which I think is good to have.
Mm-hmm. Which they end up doing that anyway in the second movie with what would you say, blue chew situation?
Yeah, he does. He needs to get a blue chew, and then eventually he gets a blue chew, and everything's good to go
from
that point on.
So to speak. But I agree. That's one minor thing that I would – there's another one, by the way, that I'm going to mention later that is a probably the hottest of hot takes regarding things that I wish they had done instead of what they do in this movie. But we'll get there. What do you make, Nick, as a longtime Spider-Man fan, of going with Mary Jane instead of Gwen Stacy in this movie?
Well, if you wanted to be, you know, most accurate to the early source material, you could have gone for Betty Brant, even, or, or Liz Allen.
Elizabeth Banks.
Either of those two would have been actually the initial love interest, because in the early pages, it was Liz Allen who was caught between Flash Thompson and Peter Parker, and very much into Peter Parker, but Peter was just too dumb to realize it. And eventually we moved on to Betty Brant, and then it wasn't until the college years that he met mm-hmm. both Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane, and then Gwen wound up becoming his first real long-term serious relationship. But I understand it. Mary Jane, in the eyes of the casual fan, is more known just because of, you know, she had more longevity in the comics. Gwen Stacy was around for like a decade and then was killed off. Mary Jane was there practically from the time Gwen was all the way up until the time this movie was released. Remember when this movie is released,
yep.
they're still married in the comics. It's still, mm-hmm. if you're going to go pick up a Spider-Man comic, you're probably going to see Mary Jane.
You're going to see Mary Jane
in that
sure.
comic. So I understand.
Love interest. And even the cartoon, which was probably the biggest exposure for Spider-Man outside mm-hmm. of the comics at that point, Mary Jane, when you watch that show, he's an adult Spider-Man and Mary Jane is his lady, right. you know? And
so I get it. I just, yeah,
I'm the same way with that, Nick. This is something that to me just always made, even at the time that I watched it, I said, I don't think that you can, you have to approach filmmaking in a different, they didn't have the leeway that the MCU has now where they can tell long form, they have the confidence they can tell a long form story. Mm-hmm. So in other words, when you're coming out of the gates with a Spider-Man movie, I don't think you can necessarily work with the assumption that, oh, we're going to get 5 Spider-Man movies, so we're going to be able to show him go through all of his relationships. I think they wanted a strong relationship for Peter, and MJ is the most identifiable one. So, yeah, it's one that doesn't bother me either. In fact, I like it. I think it makes sense in this case to start out. And likewise, I liked in Amazing Spider-Man that they went with Gwen instead of MJ. I think either one is a fine approach, but you need to go with whichever one is your long-term goal out of the gates, and that's what they do here with Mary Jane Watson.
Yeah, but me as someone who really enjoys the character of MJ, I'm not disappointed they went that direction. I'm generally speaking prefer to see Mary Jane as the love interest in my Spider-Man, but. I think, God, how long do we want to go before we get into this? I think
I know I finally have picked up on what you've been alluding to, Nick. Let's push that off just a little bit, and we'll address that.
Product placement.
Yes, the Dr. Pepper can, which I maintain Diet Dr. Pepper is better than regular Dr. Pepper.
I will disagree with that, but they're both very good.
Okay, all right.
What?
So Peter Parker's breaking all this shit in his room, right? Okay. This is a great scene, by the way. This is a great scene. Aunt May knocks on his door. What are you doing in there, Peter? Peter says, nothing. And then she goes, you're just acting so strangely recently. Okay, thanks. Closes the door.
Yep. What else are you supposed to say to that?
I pictured, it's so weird. You mentioned that you had a moment that reminded you of me earlier with Peter. That scene reminded me of you because I could totally see that exact line of dialogue happening in your household.
Why? Why do you say
that?
I don't know.
I just picture it just because you're okay. Thanks. A Billy Madison like response. But what is he doing?
I don't know.
Tinkering,
doing old man tinkering.
Yeah, and she's sewing, which is appropriate.
Yep.
Oh, this is sad. This really bummed me out. Like, but not like in a negative towards the movie, but Peter and Uncle Ben, you know, that their whole like dynamic here is a bummer because, but it's right out of the comics, right? Because Peter, I think one of the things that I really appreciated about this movie last night, and I appreciated it more after listening to Marvel Age, the early episodes, and realizing how much of a dick Peter was in the early going. You know, because let's be completely honest with ourselves, virtually all of us are dicks when we're teenagers.
Right. And especially those of us who have, like, Peter's been picked on and isolated by the vast majority of his classmates. So, like, he doesn't have the most positive of worldviews, both in the comics and even here. Like, he's not exactly a happy-go-lucky teenager. So
no, he's looking. He's not somebody that gets to be optimistic about things. He kind of defeats himself. He has no confidence in himself, and he, unfortunately, as a lot of us do, he takes out all that negativity and frustration on his parents, or in this case, his Uncle Ben and Aunt May. So when he's having bad times or going through rough times, you know, that manifests itself in sometimes the way that he talks to them. And in this case, unfortunately, it's a harsh lesson in you never know which day could be your last day to talk to somebody. So it really struck me last night watching this movie. They did a brilliant job of the acting here is great between Tobey Maguire and Cliff Robertson, but even that scene earlier in the movie, that had already happened, where they have this plan where they're going to paint the house together, and they both tell each other, you know, okay, don't start without me. And so, and then Peter gets lost trying to test out his new powers, and by the time he gets home, the house has been painted already. Like, it's over. Like, he missed the chance to have this bonding activity with Uncle Ben. Then they have this moment in the car, and he yells at him, and tells Uncle Ben that, you know, look, stop lecturing me. I don't need to hear. And I remember saying this kind of stuff to my parents when I was a teenager. Stop lecturing me. I don't need to hear a lecture right now. Stuff like that. And then, of course, as we know what's going to happen. And you have this sense of dread. If you're at all familiar with the Spider-Man story going into this movie, there's that sense of, oh, man, Peter, why'd you say that? You know?
Right.
And he never gets a chance to make it right. Which is part of the tragedy of Spider-Man. Ultimately, we get so lost, I think, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, in thinking of Spider-Man as the wisecracks and the jokes, that we forget that at its heart, he's a tragic character.
Mm-hmm.
Born from tragedy. And
tragedy throughout his life, whether it's the loss of his parents, that is, you know, kind of already happened in this film, but I would argue probably has left a mark on him. Here with Uncle mm-hmm. Ben, you know, various tragedies throughout the character's history.
And ultimately, a lot of these tragedies are self-inflicted.
The Flying Dutchman.
Ultimately, a lot of these are self-inflicted tragedies.
Yes, I would agree.
So it's
cameo from Octavia Spencer, yeah.
We're going to get one a little bit later from comedian Jim Norton as well.
I don't even know if I know who that is.
He's a bald guy. He's listed in the credits as Surly Truck Driver, who says, "I don't like him and he stinks."
Oh yeah. Did he also play Turn Himself In Guy in The Dark Knight?
He should have. So diversion from our main point of conversation here. In the ring right now is the legendary Bonesaw McGraw. Played, of course, by one of the greatest professional wrestlers of all time, the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Yep.
To my knowledge, Nick, the only movie appearance we ever got from the Macho Man, at least in a major film.
Oh, and, God, I don't know.
And boy, it's instantly iconic. I mean, just that voice, as soon as he starts talking, Bonesaw is ready, yeah.
He's essentially playing himself, let's be honest.
Yes.
Just under a different name.
He's playing Macho Man Randy Savage, to the point that he even does a flying elbow drop,
yes,
which, you know, was the signature hold or move of the Macho Man. So, could not have cast this role any better.
Mm-hmm. I like this early homemade suit, this version of it.
Yes. And this is a cartoonishly bloodthirsty wrestling crowd.
Yes.
With
large hair on these women.
And certainly an odd approach to have the female managers of Bonesaw cut promos on his opponent as his opponent walks to the ring. This poor luchador can't feel his legs.
My God.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to be injured.
And this poor luchador is suffering from the Vince McMahon ailment where he can't feel his legs, Paul.
Well, cage.
The cage is coming. Nobody in 2002 is getting that excited for just a cage match. But
this is an interesting cage, too, by the way.
I know.
How do you climb it?
I don't know. I think the idea, now work with me here, Nick. I think the idea is to keep you inside the cage.
Right. It's not an escape match.
Not an escape match, yeah. It's even got a roof on it, it appears. Or a roof, if you will. Macho Man's in an interesting place here in 2002. You know, WCW has gone under. He is still in his kind of jacked up phase here. And, you know, he's certainly ready to play the part. He's intense. He's got that Macho Man intensity. that he's so well known for. A little bit bittersweet to see this for me last night, because I was like, man, Macho Man was just such an entertainer. We didn't get enough of him.
No, we didn't. Gone too soon.
This is a great scene.
It really is.
Really, really well
done. What's Peter looking at, by the way? He's just looking at the crowd.
Boom.
Now you got to get on all fours, assume the doggy style position, and take a chair shot to the back. And nobody gets beat by it.
Doesn't nobody help. Gets beat by it.
He's going to beat him with a crowbar.
Can we just put an end to the fall? By the way, who puts all these folding chairs underneath the ring in the first place? That's what I don't get.
Oh, okay, monkey flip. That's it.
Oh, what a finish. That's a dangerous bump Macho took, too. Mm-hmm. That was one of those Naito and Ibushi bumps there right on his neck.
Mm-hmm. Peter has
That's what they don't tell
defeated
you.
Bonesaw McGraw via knockout. Ref stoppage.
Yeah, the referee actually, for some reason, counted to three instead of just checking on the arm.
Don't know what the rules of the New York Wrestling League are.
That's a good point, I suppose.
We do know this guy's a douche, though.
This guy is... Is this not an accurate representation of wrestling promoters?
I mean, I've never met any wrestling promoters.
Well, let's just say they have a reputation of ripping off their talents.
Of being scumbags?
Yes, being scumbags who don't pay what they promise their talents, they'll pay them. Poor Peter should have just stretched the match out for another minute.
I know, he should have carried him.
Yep. I wonder if... Well, that's the problem, is they never smartened Peter up. He didn't know it was a word.
Look at the hair on this guy.
This is very 2002. There are a couple things in this moment that are very in this movie that are very 2002, mm-hmm. and this guy's hairstyle is one of them. He looks like every MTV VJ for this time.
I was gonna say ROH Nigel McGuinness hair.
Yeah, yeah. NSYNC hair.
Peter just lets him go.
What's the matter with you, kid?
No, that guy had smoker voice. I remember it watching it last night.
And here's the other thing. When you're watching this movie, up to this point, I'm going along with pretty much every decision that Peter is making in this movie.
I'm good with that one, even. Where he's like, yeah. No, fuck this guy. You know, why am I going to...
He used his own words against him, yep.
Everything so far, I'm like, hey, man, I get it.
And that's the beauty, I think, of this story. You think to yourself, I would have done everything the exact same way, and then you see that sometimes... Our own decisions can lead to unforeseen consequences.
Right.
And that's what you get here when Peter realizes that his Uncle Ben has been killed, and in a few more minutes after he goes for revenge, he is going to realize that, in his eyes anyway, it's his fault that he had a chance to stop this guy, and he didn't. By the way, I've never liked the retcon in Spider-Man 3.
The Sandman retcon.
I've never liked that.
I'm trying to remember the details of it exactly.
Wasn't it revealed that he was the driver of the wheel man?
He was the driver, and he was the one who shot? No.
I can't remember.
He had something to do with it, but no, I'm the same way. One of the aspects of the Burton movie, the Batman movie that I never liked, was the Jack Nicholson, you know, being revealed to be the murderer of Bruce Wayne's parents thing, which they later tried to change to... Tooth? I don't even know. But like, yeah, I don't think that every villain needs to be connected back to the inciting incident necessarily. So
right. And so I in this movie there's no implication that anyone else is involved.
Right.
It's just that guy.
Right.
And I think it works better that way. And this is good stuff. This whole scene with Toby and Cliff Robertson. Oh my God, the other thing. When I was watching this scene last night, in my head, and maybe it's because it happens in Amazing Spider-Man, but in my head I had remembered that there's this, you know, dramatic death scene where Uncle Ben says, Peter, with great, and reminds him again that with great power comes great responsibility. Remember that, and grabs his hand or something. And there's nothing. He just says, Peter, and it looks like he's in agony. And it's heartbreaking. Like, it really, like, upset me last night watching this scene, because I was like, that's it? Like, Uncle Ben just dies in agony? Like, crying? Like, that's not how I remembered it. Like... I remember him having the over dramatic Dave Chappelle death scene. Oh, death!
Here's one moment where the CGI is not holding up for me personally.
No, not at all.
It looks rough.
We get a few moments like that through 17 years later eyes. At the time, all this stuff looked amazing, but or spectacular or web of. But
friendly neighborhood.
Absolutely. There are several moments like this in the movie, Nick. Later on, even when he's swinging through New York City, where his body movements look so unnatural. Not Darth Sidious unnatural, but like just unnatural, like the way that his legs are flailing about and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were limited. They were really limited on what they could do. Technology.
I think it's also with this particular suit having to do like the effect of the sweater riding up, and it has a little bit more motion to it. Whereas the later one is just a straight body suit, so it's kind of rigid at all times. And I think it is easier to animate, probably.
Rigid, I like that. Speaking of rigid, later on in this film, Nick, because I don't know when we'll get there, but Peter encounters a young, or not young, but Elizabeth Banks playing Betty Brant.
Mm-hmm.
I think he should have pursued.
Well, he was in love with Mary Jane.
He's in love with Mary Jane, but Mary Jane was with Harry at that time.
Well, and that's another dick move by Harry.
Well, come on. I can somewhat agree with that, but Harry was also upset because he felt like Peter was unintentionally supplanting his relationship with his father. And so, because Norman takes a Vince McMahon with the Sandman like fascination with Peter Parker.
It is interesting, that's for sure.
Yes. Well, he also takes an infatuation.
Get a unit to the rear.
Norman also takes an interest in one area of Mary Jane Watson's body later in the film. We'll talk about that.
It's a decent area. Fair area.
In a very unnerving scene. But anyway, anyway. I haven't even done my Norman voice yet. I don't know if I can.
This is pretty brutal. Peter throwing down on him.
Yeah. Any time that this movie has like an intense fight scene like this, like a one-on-one kind of fight scene like this, it's really brutal and intense because there's one later on in the film. Here's the moment where Peter realizes. There's a moment later on in the film where he rescues Mary Jane in the rain. And has this fight with these thugs, and I thought it was fantastic. Probably my favorite fight scene in the movie. Impactful, one might say. He does look a little bit like Nigel McGuinness in the hair area, the hairia, if you will,
a little bit.
So, So they've. This is again. This is right how I remember reading it in versions of this story as a kid. I never read the original comics, obviously, but. This is pretty straight on. And even this scene kind of reminds me a little bit of Burton's Batman with the look of the building from the outside and the spotlight and all that.
Yep.
I think there's a lot of loving homages in this film from Sam Raimi. So let's talk about Tobey Maguire plays Spider-Man here. I'm not sure what he was most well known for prior to this. Probably
Pleasantville?
Was that before this or after? I honestly don't know. It was before this, 98. So, probably Pleasantville. The Cider House Rules was another one that he had done that he was well known for.
Never seen it.
But he was cast as this, and I was just talking to my dad earlier tonight because he asked me what our topic was this week. I said the original Spider-Man. He said the Tobey Maguire one. I said, yeah. And he said, oh, I love that movie. He's still my favorite Spider-Man. And so he does a great job here, man. Like, he's instantly identifiable. And I think, if anything, his performance is even better than I remembered it being. Because, I don't know, like, it's been so long since I've watched this with fresh eyes. You know, I was kind of joking at the beginning of the show about my long hatred of Willem Dafoe's performance in this. But, honestly, I've always, and you've known me for all these years, and I've always kind of downplayed this movie.
Yeah, I know.
Historically. And, This is the first time, though, that I've watched it with fresh eyes. Because you have to understand, I watched this movie four times in the movie theater with my friends. Like, we went back and saw it.
So how did you get from loving it to downplaying it?
I think I saw it too much. It was a combination of factors. I saw it so many times, and after seeing it that many times in the theater, watching it on video when it came out, watching it on TV whenever it would come on, I saw it so many times, and it was one of those deals where I think I retroactively downgraded it based on how good the follow-up was.
Right.
So X-Men 2 came out the next year and was a better movie. And so because – and this is an unfair thing that I think a lot of people do nowadays, and I did it back then. The new thing comes out, and I instantly think, well, I have to downgrade whatever I saw before.
Right.
Because of how good this was.
Right.
Spider-Man 2 came out and was a better movie than this one by a pretty good margin. And so, well, that must mean the first Spider-Man movie was not as good as we thought it was. So
I've always thought the gap between Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2 is smaller than you've made it out to be, but we've been down that road so many times.
And I think that you think that Amazing Spider-Man is better than Spider-Man 2. So
you are misrepresenting that argument all over the place now, but I will allow you to continue.
You're the one that had the rankings.
No, I had the rankings of my favorite ones, and I explained, hey, even though Spider-Man 2 is probably a better made movie, The Amazing Spider-Man has a version of the character that I connect with more that has a greater emotional impact on me.
Mm. Out am I? Anyway. So at a certain point over time, I just kind of grew to sort of dismiss this movie. And I think watching it with fresh eyes allowed me to approach Tobey Maguire's performance with fresh eyes, and also to put away the sequels, put away Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3, and just look at this movie for what it is. And I honestly struggle to think of what he could have done better. He is outstanding, whether it's portraying the pain and the torment that he's going through right now, whether it's his moments of sheer joy when he's Spider-Man or when he's getting his powers, when he, you know, that thinks he's going to get this new car to impress Mary Jane, whether it's his moments of anger and rage, which is a big thing that I really liked, is seeing when he gets pissed off, I buy it. And he's just really, really good. And I think he deservingly carved out a niche in pop culture where this is always going to be the role that he's remembered for more than any other. He's a good actor. He's done Seabiscuit, which I think he got nominated for an award for. He's done a lot of good movies, but this is what he'll always be known for. And I think that's a deserved honor, like Keaton with Batman or whoever you want to throw up there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He's great. No, it's one of the, there are other characters in casting in this franchise that I've had my ups and downs with, but Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man is really good. It's a different version of the character than I have in my head and that I am most attached to, but it's still a very valid interpretation of the character and probably one that's closer to the classic, you know, 1960s Stan Lee and Steve Ditko interpretation. So
yeah, this movie in general owes a lot to the Lee and Ditko era of Spider-Man, I think, in terms of both the story that it's telling and some of the aesthetic choices that they make. But yes, this he's great. The co-lead, I guess you would say, the co-lead would be Dafoe, and we should talk about him. But I may need to explain myself more with that one. But I guess we'll go ahead and do Willem Dafoe because the Mary Jane topic might be a little more unique. So, Willem Dafoe. At the time I mentioned, he was one of the things I always didn't like about this. I thought he was way over the top, which he is way over the top.
But so is the movie.
At the time, right. And at the time I thought that was a bad thing. And in this case, if he was doing this performance in a Christopher Nolan movie, it probably wouldn't have fit.
Right. No, it definitely wouldn't have fit.
But doing this performance in a Sam Raimi movie works perfect.
Yes.
And even in a Spider-Man movie in general, it works perfect. So, Willem Dafoe. The other thing that I didn't remember about his Norman Osborn is that at times Norman comes off like a good guy.
He stinks, and I don't like him.
Yeah, so at times in this movie, Norman has moments of kindness. Yeah. And, like, and moments where he comes off like a loving father, or, you know, obviously there's some distance. That's Lucy Lawless, by the way.
Was it really?
Yep. And I didn't realize that until I looked it up last night. But the there is some distance, or significant distance, between he and Harry, obviously, because of Norman always being busy with work and all that. But there are moments in this movie where, oh gosh,
I we have to we have to put Willem Dafoe aside for a moment and just go ahead, right. Like,
it doesn't get
spent,
any better.
We've spent 2 weeks, I think, talking about this pretty much ever since Far From Home came out, how happy we were to see J.K. Simmons back as J. Jonah Jameson. And, you know, I said on this podcast, you and I have talked about privately, there's just no way you can get anybody to do it better. And even though we know that there's no way to get anybody to do it better, I think I had forgotten just how damn good it was. And then
it's perfect.
It's everything. Like, I would totally watch the movie if it were nothing but this scene for an hour. Like, where people keep coming to his office and keep yelling at people.
And not to be another thing that I noticed, not to be outdone or overlooked, Bill Nunn as Robbie Robertson and his just befuddled reaction to everything that Jonah does and says.
Where do I know the name Bill Nunn from?
I don't know, but I've seen him in other stuff, but he just, Robbie looks like at any point he's just ready to throw himself out this window because he works for a tyrant. it is magnificent, Nick. And this scene is
what a line. He doesn't want to be famous. I'll make him infamous. Ah, the best.
Also, this movie probably has the best version of comic book newspaper journalism of any that I've seen.
Sure, yeah.
They just do things
with no regard. Like, there was this major advertising snafu, and he was like, "Oh, just give the other guy a different page."
Yeah,
and he was like, "That's it." As if that's all there is to it.
Yep, it's perfect because, like, just if you've ever worked for a tyrannical newspaper publisher, J. Jonah Jameson in this movie is an accurate representation. And both of us have worked for tyrannical newspaper publishers at a time or two in our time, Nick.
Indeed we have, but that's neither here nor there.
Sniff, sniff, sniff. Yeah, just the fact that he just commands these things to happen that are irrational to request, his first concern is how he can pay people the least amount of money.
Yeah.
it's just, he is just magnificent. I don't know if he grew up reading Spider-Man comics or not. I don't know how J.K. Simmons captured the voice of J. Jonah Jameson so perfectly well. I have no clue to this day how he did it.
Me neither, but it's amazing. And every, like, even in Spider-Man 3, which we've discussed before, is not the greatest conclusion to the series, that might be the best J. Jonah Jameson movie, because he's in it the most of any of the three movies. He's in that one all throughout it, and is hilarious in every scene to the end.
Yep, he is. He's a marvel, so to speak.
Indeed.
And, yeah, so back to Willem Dafoe. Not to be confused with Willem Dafriend, who he now has become to me.
I knew we were going to.
And I really liked his performance last night.
I know.
I can't lie. I watched the movie, and it didn't take long. It was pretty much his first scene. His facial expressions are amazing.
Yes.
I mentioned earlier the facial dexterity, and here's a line I always repeat: "Stormin' Norman's back at it again." Anyway, just his ability to contort his face into ways that I wouldn't think possible without CGI or prosthetics. It's incredible. The sudden mood shifts, as at this point in the movie, I think Norman still doesn't know that he is the Green Goblin. They're the same, one and the same. So, just those wild mood shifts of you can't do this to me!
Do you know how much I've sacrificed?
And then he instantly goes into, like, sympathetic mode, like, oh, I forget the guy's name, but, oh, George, please. Sorry, Norman.
You're out. Am I?
It's so good. It's so good.
It really is.
Now that you really pissed me off.
Finish it!
Make your choice, hero.
This is a great line.
We are who we choose to be.
You used to make fun of that line specifically. That used to be your one.
I did, yep. That was my one.
That was your one.
We are who we choose to be, hero. I can't make fun of it any longer, Nick.
You used to rag on it. You used to dump on it.
It's amazing. He is amazing in the movie. There's just no getting around it. He's a great villain.
The best scene in the movie, especially from him, is the Thanksgiving scene at the apartment.
Oh, yes.
Between what actually takes place in the apartment and then he and Harry's little like secondary scene that immediately follows in the hallway, just everything.
Go ahead and give the line. Go ahead and give the line.
Do a word to the wise for about your little girlfriend. Do what you need to do with her, and then broom her fast.
I have never heard the term broomer outside of this movie.
And yet, you understand what it means, and it is a hell of a heel line, is it not?
It is. It is great.
$300 for a photo. In what world?
2002 journalism, apparently.
I guess. Shit, I would have taken freelance work at that point.
Absolutely. Another great line here, as Peter says, I was hoping to get a job. Job? There's no job, just freelance. Best thing for a kid your age.
Yep.
And he says, I'll get you some meat, some good Christmas meat. That's all I can give you. And at my newspaper employer, instead of bonuses or raises, they gave us Christmas meat every year.
So, it is remarkable to me that the worst employer I ever had was the only one who ever gave me a Christmas bonus.
I know. I was shocked when you told me that yesterday.
Yep.
We
got one week's pay at Christmas.
We don't get Christmas bonuses now, but we get raises, which is fine. That's a fair trade off to me.
Yes,
but the annual gift of a ham did not. Don't get me wrong. Now I appreciate a good ham, but did not necessarily make up for lack of raise.
Here we go. I know you're looking forward to this. Cool. The boardroom scene.
This scene is everything. Like, I would put this right behind the Thanksgiving scene as my favorite among Norman scenes in the movie.
Norman scenes?
It reminds me.
I don't know.
Me
of I think the scene of him where they're cutting back and forth between him and his reflection in the mirror, that's probably my favorite.
Tell me how!
No, you're thinking of the one where he's talking to the mask later on.
That's right.
I'm talking about like where he first – it is first – like we know that he's the Green Goblin, but he first comes to understand that he's the Green Goblin. And so Norman is like walking towards the mirror, and the reflection in the mirror is the Green Goblin. And he's delivering lines essentially to himself, just going back and forth. It's awesome.
You can't do this to me. I started this company.
Oh, look at that face.
Look, I sacrificed.
Yes. Oh, Max, please.
Max, please.
Max, sure. You're in a wheelchair. You feel bad for me. I feel bad for you.
This is amazing. Just his emoting.
Here's this guy with his pretentious sip of tea.
I'm gonna ask you another thing, and I don't know if I'm supposed to feel this way, but I'll tell you how I felt. I actually feel bad for Norman at this point in the movie. Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. Because
He did start the company.
He was making progress on this project, and this douche general comes in and is like, well, I'm going to essentially bankrupt your company because you're not moving fast enough. And he has to take these rash actions to save his company. And then after all of that, personal sacrifice, destroying Quest Aerospace and stuff, like, they sell the company out from under him anyway. So everything he did was for nothing, essentially.
It's for nothing. And you have to understand that he, at this point, I don't believe that he knows that he's the Green Goblin yet, does he?
No, he doesn't. I don't think so.
He's going to find that out pretty shortly.
Macy Gray.
Macy Gray, another very 2002 thing.
What a time in pop culture it was.
Of course, those of you who are listening to this show that may not remember 2002, Macy Gray was very popular at this time because she did that song, I try to say goodbye and I choke. That one, where she kind of sounded like Bob Dylan.
I was about
to
say, you made her sound like Bob Dylan.
That's kind of how she sang it.
No, you know, she didn't sound like Bob Dylan. She just sounded like...
I walk away and I crumble.
I don't know. She kind of sounded like the natural evolution of Margot Kidder, I guess.
Oh, I can see that, yes. I can see that. I guess if it was Bob Dylan, it would be more like, yeah, try to say goodbye, not you.
There you go.
Old man Bob Dylan.
I'm convinced this guy was going to play J. Jonah Jameson, and they didn't want to fire him, so they let him do something else.
How come Mary Jane's wearing a kimono?
It's the World Unity Festival, so you'll see a variety of different ethnic dresses and stuff.
I'm not opposed to it, but at the time...
Why is this guy wearing giant leather gloves? Here we go.
Leather gloves are a popular look among businessmen in movies, I've learned.
They are. Max Schreck in Batman Returns wore leather gloves.
Absolutely. Patrick Bateman.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember the scene in the bathroom where he removes the glove and the man grabs his hand
mm-hmm.
in the bathroom. What is this thing? Now, I've praised Norman Osborn. I've praised Willem Dafoe. It's a great performance. It's a great character. The writing of him is excellent in this movie. The writing in this movie in general, by the way, is really good. The script is really good.
For the most part, yeah.
Let me make my hot take.
Okay.
And I know you're going to instantly disagree with me, but I'm going to make it anyway.
Okay.
Instead of this, they should have gone with the original costume that they were testing for this movie.
I don't have that big of an issue with that. I don't really know what the decision is. Why did they do this? I've never understood it. There was a brief Stan cameo, by the way.
So I read some things, and I don't know if what's true and what's not true, but what I had read is that they had issues
getting it to work,
right in all situations, and that it was very cumbersome to wear the mask in particular. Obviously, we're referring to the mask; we're not referring to the costume.
So, yeah, as you can see on screen, the Green Goblin is kind of wearing this exosuit, like this metallic green battle armor essentially, and it has some goblin like features, some teeth added onto it, little ears and stuff, but it is definitely not in the comics it's just like a cloth mask and a little purple hood like thing. That's essentially the costume. And a piece of footage that leaked a couple of years ago, Greg, I don't remember exactly when.
Yeah, it was about 2 years ago, yeah.
That they actually tested a more comic book accurate look for the Green Goblin that looked good based on the test footage. Mm-hmm. But upon seeing it, it was one of those where the mask was going to move, very much like, kind of like the current Spider-Man mask does, you know, where, with the shifting eyes and stuff. They were trying to accomplish something like that, but through practical effects. And back in 2002... the first time I saw that, I was like, oh, man, I wonder if part of the reason they didn't do it was because it just didn't work all the time. So I would have to assume that's why they do it. The look has never – the redesign of the character has never bothered me. Like, I understand why they did it. Yes, I would have preferred the comic book version, but I'm not – the only thing I don't like about it is you're taking one of the most expressive actors in the history of movies and sticking him under this
hood. That's exactly what I thought.
Now, granted, later in the movie they will – slide up the lenses or whatever to let you get a shot of his eyes at least, but yeah, it's hindering Willem a little bit.
I've always hated the fact that the mouth doesn't move. The mouth is open. I think if it was a closed mouth, it would be better. But with the mouth being open and not moving, it's always looked goofy to me. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's a point. Yes, the real costume looks goofy too. But I'm telling you, we talked about this footage leaked on our podcast. Like watching this footage that like. It's creepy as hell. And yes, it's scary almost. It's horrifying almost. But it's awesome. And it's so expressive. Like the face... And I read online that apparently before they ever cast Willem Dafoe as the Green Goblin, they were doing these tests in like 2000. And they based the facial structure on Willem Dafoe before he even was cast as the Green Goblin.
Right.
Because of how expressive his face is. And it's great, and I know that maybe it would have delayed the movie, maybe it was unreasonable to try it, but gosh, I kind of wish they had, because like you said, you've got one of the most expressive actors of all time, and you're kind of covering up his features.
Yeah, and so the test mask was intended to allow the wearer to contort the mask using his face? I mean, like, was that how it was supposed to work?
I think so. I don't know. I can't get... I've watched the footage several times, and I can't understand like if it's operated remotely or if it's done by the wearer somehow.
And here's Harry trying to buy his way back into Mary Jane's good graces.
One thing that we missed due to a technical snafu was Harry Osborn's flare flop after getting bonked on the head by a falling brick. So Norman is great, though. He's a great character. Harry Osborn, played by James Franco, who I think it wasn't known for anything before this movie.
Freaks and Geeks would have been the only thing before this.
Which I've never seen.
It's very good.
He plays Harry Osborn, and he is great. Yep. He's better in the second one, I think, than he is in this one, but he's really good in this one. And again, it's a version of Harry that I can actually recognize. A version of Harry who is Peter's friend, who is also very flawed. Much like Peter is flawed, Harry is an extremely flawed individual. He's jealous. He's clearly messed up from his relationship with his dad. The mom's out of the picture, obviously. And Harry sometimes reacts quickly to things. He reacts emotionally, jealousy, rage, says stupid things all the time. He makes some rather demeaning remarks to Mary Jane, actually, in this movie a couple times, where he's like, why did you wear that? I wanted you to wear this other thing to mm-hmm. impress my father, you know? here we go. Another great Defoe scene.
I think it's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's the one you're talking about. Yep. And, Franco, I think, is excellent here and does a good job.
Just look at the decor of this place. Like, this looks like all the weird shit that was hanging around Wayne Manor in the 89 mm-hmm. Batman Burton movie.
You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Yep.
And indeed, Norman does get nuts.
They should let Willem Dafoe play the Joker in a Batman movie.
Oh, it totally would work. I don't know if he'd want to, because it's kind of a similar character in some ways to the Green Goblin in terms of the insanity and the smiling and the laughing and all that. But he would have been perfect as the Joker. Imagine Willem Dafoe if they ever did a Dark Knight Returns live-action adaptation mm-hmm. as that version of the Joker.
There he is, breaking another glass.
That's what he does. Shatters glasses and clears tables in movies. It almost looks like a Predator mask on that stick.
Maybe it is.
Next to the cabinet there. So, you would agree that Franco does a good job as Harry?
Yeah, Franco's good. I've never really had an issue with Franco. My only ever issue with Franco ever comes in the writing of Franco in the third one, where they, like, kind of botch what should have been a relatively simple story, but that's a whole other thing. Franco's really good in the first two.
Yep. I guess we're finally there, Nick.
All right.
Kirsten Dunst, who her most famous role before Spider-Man was certainly Interview with the Vampire.
Right. And Virgin Suicides was before this too, I think?
Yes, 1999.
There you go.
She was also in Little Women. She was in Jumanji, Wag the Dog. So she'd been in a ton of things, more than I even realized. Mm-hmm. But certainly Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, yeah, I forget she was in Jumanji. Yeah.
Yep. She was a child at that time, 12 years old in that movie. And that's sort of what made her famous, I guess. She also, of course, does Bring It On in 2000.
Oh, yeah.
Which is before this, and that was a popular film at the time, particularly in my age group. and here she is as Mary Jane Watson.
What a great Jonah Jameson line, by the way.
What, which one?
Oh, Peter says, Mr. Jameson, that's libel. It is not. I resent that. All right, it's slander. In print, it's libel.
In print, it's libel. Let him sue me. Get rich like everybody else.
Oh, God. So but here's Jameson having a little bit of a spine, not giving Peter
Thank
up.
Thank you.
This is good stuff.
He is not a caricature. Right. He is not a one-dimensional, I hate Spider-Man, so I'm a bad guy character. He actually defends. He's willing to defend to his own death the identity of Peter Parker as one of his employees.
Right.
An admirable moment for a guy who has a lot of non-admirable moments.
Sleep.
I never liked this either. Why would he say sleep?
Because he's willing to follow. He can do whatever he wants. Shut up.
Sleep.
Anyway, let's get back to what we were... Let's get back All on right. topic here.
So, Kirsten Dunst plays Mary Jane Watson. You're gonna have a strong take on this. I will just say, having watched this game last night, I liked her a lot. I really did. God. I really did. I thought
she's not good in this. She's not.
I disagree.
Her performance is really wooden at times. Mary Jane.
I bought their relationship.
I buy the relationship, but it's almost entirely because Tobey Maguire is so good. And anytime the character, and really the character doesn't really have any scenes outside of scenes with Peter or Harry, she doesn't really have much of her own defined personality in this movie.
That's fair.
And that's a criticism I have of, you know, of this thing. The writing is not very good. So even if you had gotten a better actress to play it, I don't really know that I would have come around to loving it at any point. But also, I just think she's wooden through a large chunk of the film. I don't buy her. She just doesn't hold her own next to the performances of Maguire and Osborne. And this is... or Franco, Defoe. Sorry. Franco, yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
Defoe. And also, and this is a stupid comment to even make, but I'm going to make it anyway. Mary Jane Watson in the comics is a freaking supermodel. And Kirsten Dunst is attractive, don't get me wrong, but I don't know. There was always a disconnect there for me.
Sorry, I'm trying to figure out what the hell they're saying in the scene. I can't remember. And my stupid subtitles aren't working. So I was actually shocked that I liked this performance better than I remembered from her. I know that you were talking about how wooden she is, but like I don't know. I think she gets moments to portray vulnerability, certainly, but she also gets some moments to stand up for herself and show that, you know.
Yeah, she gets moments to show her nipples. That's what you like.
I do like that, Nick. I'm going to be honest with you. The rain scene, Nick, is one of the best scenes in the movie for many reasons. Well, a couple of reasons in particular. And
have you ever seen the Spider-Man XXX porn parody?
I have not.
Well, there's a scene that rips off the rain scene where there's a kiss, right? And then Spider-Man goes back up the web, and when he comes back down, he's removed his pants, and she performs upside-down suspended oral sex on him.
I feel like that's where the scene was going, if it hadn't been interrupted.
Yeah,
you know. But no, she. I do enjoy Kirsten Dunst in that regard in this movie. But I think that her performance is solid in the film overall. She doesn't. I will agree with you that she doesn't get enough to do. That's hardly a problem unique to the Spider-Man film, though. That's something that we see, unfortunately, a lot in superhero movies. But with the romantic interests. But I don't know. I think that she's got a little bit of agency to her. She's a little bit Vicky Vale-like in that regard, and that she doesn't get a ton to do. But, you know, she does get moments here or there to show some personality, some spunk, if you will. But I understand where you're coming from as well. For a long time, I've kind of felt the same. And maybe that's one of the reasons that Mary Jane's never been a preferred character for me, because I remember even on the cartoon, I always thought that she was a little bland, I guess you would say, in terms of her personality. Yeah, you're right. The writing was kind of lackluster on her character. I like the writing. I mentioned I love the writing overall in this movie, but I like their relationship, the writing of their relationship. But I think, you know, we don't get to see enough of Mary Jane outside of the context of Peter. On the other hand,
you get a little bit more of that in Spider-Man 2, and I still feel the same way.
Yes, we do.
Is that she's just her portrayal is so wooden that it doesn't do much for me.
This is good. This is a Spider-Man I like right here. Time comes to kick some ass.
Or just damn mask.
I forget. Time comes to you're in the mall, you know, this is a Spider-Man that he's at the mall and he sees this large Austrian man coming up, and you know, he just turns to the woman he loves and he tells her, "Hey, you want to watch me kick some ass?"
You are amazing. There you go.
He is. He's also spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And if he fights Kraven, he'll be fighting one gigantic motherfucker.
They should get Arnold to play Kraven in the Far From Home.
Dude, support. Would that not have been perfect, like, back in this day?
Shit, do it now. I don't care.
I don't give a fuck. you don't learn. You don't forget how to work, motherfucker. It'd be great. It'd be great. But I want to know what happened to the mall security guard from Commando. Why does he never get work?
Apparently, when they were filming the scene, Tobey Maguire had to put like plugs in his nose to keep water. Because first few times they shot it, he kept getting water in his nose, and they had to like, you know, start turning back upright because of the. He almost, you know, not drowned, but he was having major issues.
I remember this got, I remember this got Best Kiss at the MTV Movie Awards.
Yeah, it's truly a prestigious award.
Yes, come on. Act like you wouldn't be excited to win that golden bucket of popcorn.
You can't eat it.
I know, it's golden. You probably could eat it, but...
It probably wouldn't be very good.
No. You'd have what you refer to, Nick, as stone innards.
Mm-hmm. Like your innards. Half an hour and
sometimes I have trouble. You know, maybe I need up my dietary fiber.
Well, I've heard that you can be helped with that by a Squatty Potty, which of course is sponsoring our good friends over at the DC4U podcast.
That's exactly right. I got to be honest, I'm a believer in that Squatty Potty. I wasn't for a long time.
I had no discernible difference for me, but
I
never had the issues that you and other individuals did.
I don't. My tendency is not to believe the word of the infomercial salesman, just in general.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes they tell the truth. You know who else told the truth? Gary Spivey of the Psychic Friends Network.
So we've hit all the major performances. Anything else we need to touch on here before we?
Shit, I don't know. Are there any that were? Oh, Bruce Campbell in his cameo earlier that we should have mentioned. Okay. He's great, as usual. He gets better in the sequels. The
popular fan theory was that he was playing Mysterio.
Mm-hmm. And he gets better. I think he has better cameos in 2 and 3, actually.
I think the 2 is actually my favorite, because the 3 one, I remember it just went on for so long, it was kind of like, all right, you know, I get the joke. Let's move past it. The 2 was where he played the douchey Usher. That was my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Rosemary Harris as May.
Oh, that's real good.
She's really good too, although she does get an over the top scene as well when Ormond attacks her and she's
saying the Lord's Prayer.
Finish it.
Yes. And here the Green Goblin is wrapped in a old woman's shawl. Spider Sense does him no good here.
You're so predictable. The itsy bitsy spider went up the water spout. Down came the goblin and took the spider out.
Oh, what a terrible line. It. Terrible comeback line from Spider-Man. It's you who's out. Out of your mind.
Fine, Norman. Not Norman. He doesn't know he's Norman. Gobby. He calls him Gobby, though.
He does.
There he is.
That was cool.
That's a cool scene. Yeah. Yep. A little Matrix-inspired, of course. Yep.
He's going to be clipped here. He's going to set up the Thanksgiving scene,
Which is a great scene.
Great scene.
Okay, one thing that we definitely need to talk about. We talked about this when Homecoming came out a little bit. The similarities of the of that scene and the best scene in Homecoming, which is that the car scene.
Yeah.
It's great because one character knows who the other is and the other one doesn't.
Right.
Like, it's this outstanding. Or actually, in that case, they both know. But it's that tension of secret information being held, you know, and somebody else being unaware of it in the room. So good. So good. And this Thanksgiving scene is that.
Well, and the car scene in Homecoming is also, you're getting to see, you know, this villain who Peter is obviously intimidated by, put it together over the course of the car ride. And it kind of, the intensity there just kind of ramps up as you go along.
Yep. And I would even say before they get into the car, when he just arrives at the house.
Yeah. There, it's kind of inverted version. He sees him. He's like, oh shit. Yeah.
Yep. It's the inverted version of this one where Norman sees Peter's cut. And that's what really puts it across. Although there's great tension this whole scene long. Cause you get the idea that Norman is suspicious. Like, you know,
right.
Really good stuff.
Oh God! Well, is there? There's Peter. There's Norman giving Mary Jane the twice there, over.
Yeah, not a once over. Look at his face. Is that not creepy?
It is.
Lord God Almighty, he's staring right at her cleavage.
One of the only impressive aspects of her performance, her cleavage.
Well, there's a moment at the lunch table also where he's trying to eat early, and Aunt May slaps his hand, and Norman gives her a look that looks as if he wants to disembowel her right then and there for stopping him from getting his turkey.
No, he was getting some sweet potatoes. The marshmallows off the top of the sweet potatoes. No blood splatter splashes like that, by the way. What kind of ketchup blood is Spider-Man leaking?
And so you're saying he didn't blade? He was using a blood packet?
Mm.
So Norman takes his fingers and he licks his fingers, and it's very off-putting. In any event, good stuff there. Rosemary Harris is great. So yeah, I guess that's pretty much all there is to say. Performance-wise. Otherwise, there's also some good action in this movie. Some of it doesn't hold up very well due to the CGI constraints. But we already talked about some good fight scenes as well in this one. Overall, assessment, this movie is really, really good. Yes. It holds up very, very well, in my opinion. From a storytelling standpoint, it's... that's a gigantic turkey.
There's that finger lick.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Who could resist Willem Dafoe? My gosh. What a looker. In any event, I love this movie, man. I like it more than I remembered liking it. It reminded me, and the other part, and nostalgia plays a factor in this too, Nick, because when I was watching this last night, I was flooded with these memories of watching it for the first time. Because it's been so long since I've seen it, it reminded me of the first time watching it with my friends, and some of those people I'm still friends with today, many of them I've fallen out of contact with. And so it was kind of, I was just remembering that experience that brought us all together all those years ago, and what a landmark movie this was at the time, because it's really hard to explain it for people that maybe joined the superhero movie train later on, just what this meant to comic book fans at the time, because it was... particularly for Spider-Man fans, it was what Green Lantern should have been for us. So it really was.
Yeah, I still enjoyed the movie very much. You know, we said last week when we were doing our Spider-Man rankings, I said to me, the Spider-Man franchise has given us 6 really good to great movies, 1 below average movie, and 1 just unwatchable piece of trash. And I think this is one of the 6. Really good to great movies, in my estimation, anyway.
Yes, and the unwatchable piece of trash, in your estimation, of course, was Spider-Man 2.
Was the amazing Spider-Man 2. You forgot the adjective.
Yeah. Look at the adjective. Play.
That's right. There it was.
Well, I've revealed this on Twitter, actually, Nick, mm-hmm. that as a result of this rewatch, I actually have bumped up this movie in my Spider-Man rankings 1 slot. I actually now have it ranked ahead of Homecoming in my personal Spider-Man movie ranking. Still below Far From Home, Into the Spider-Verse, Spider-Man 2, but I'm just a big fan of it, man. I can't explain how shocked I was at how much I liked it last night.
I think I've revisited this one a little bit more often than you have, so my rankings haven't changed. It's still... Spider-Man 3 is dead last by a wide, or excuse me, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is dead last by a wide margin. Then you have Spider-Man 3 at 7, this at 6, Spider-Man 2 at 5, Amazing Spider-Man at 4, Homecoming at 3, Far From Home at 2, and Into the Spider-Verse at 1.
And my rankings are at 8, Amazing Spider-Man 2, at 7, Spider-Man 3, 6, Amazing Spider-Man, 5, Homecoming, 4, Spider-Man, 3, Far From Home, 2, Into the Spider-Verse, and 1, Spider-Man 2. Let's look at what our listeners have to say, Nick, or at least our friends on Twitter, shall we?
I guess.
We've gotten a number of lists submitted. I prompted for them on the old Twitter machine. David Sunday, the host of Sunday Groove here on Place to Be Nation Pop, has submitted his list, and his includes at number 8, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. At number 7, Spider-Man 3. At number 6, Spider-Man. At number 5, Amazing Spider-Man. At number 4, Spider-Man Homecoming. At 3, Into the Spider-Verse. At 2, Far From Home. And at 1, Spider-Man 2. That is a pretty damn good list, David. Then we have our good buddy Russell Sellers, who has at number 8, but with like 9 asterisks ahead of it to create an impassable chasm, Amazing Spider-Man 2. At number 7, Spider-Man 3. At number 6, Spider-Man. At number 5, Amazing Spider-Man. At number 4, Homecoming. 3, Far From Home. 2, Spider-Man 2. And at 1, Into the Spider-Verse. Pretty good list there, my friend. Let's move up a little bit on this deal here. A lot of anti-Spider-Man 3 comments here from our good friends Greg Russino and Mike. Russino's list. Are you ready for this, Nick?
Oh, God. I don't know. Probably not.
He has not seen Far From Home. here's his list, though. At number 7, Spider-Man 3. At number 6, Amazing Spider-Man 2, which that... You got to rewatch it, Greg. If you're listening to the show, yeah, which I know you're not.
He's not.
You've got to rewatch Amazing Spider-Man 2. You will change your list. At number 5, Amazing Spider-Man. 4, Spider-Man. 3, Homecoming. 2, Spider-Man 2. And 1, Into the Spider-Verse. Now, who do we have next in our list of lists? We've got Stephanie, longtime friend of the show. She has weighed in, and she has got at number 8, Spider-Man 3. Oh, this is very shocking. At number 8, Spider-Man 3. At number 7, Spider-Man 2. At number 6, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. At number 5, Homecoming. At 4, Amazing Spider-Man. At 3, Spider-Man. At 2, Far From Home. And at 1, Into the Spider-Verse. That is a shocking list to me. Todd submitted a list. How about this one? Let's find out. Good stuff, Stephanie. Thank you for your list. Todd, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is at 8. Spider-Man 3 at 7. Spider-Man at 6. The Amazing Spider-Man at 5. Into the Spider-Verse at 4. Homecoming at 3. Far From Home at 2. And Spider-Man 2 still at number 1. And that list is backed up by Mike on Twitter. Joe Johnson, our good friend, at Dallas Jose 91. Amazing Spider-Man 2 at 8. Amazing Spider-Man at 7. Spider-Man 3 at 6. Spider-Man at 5. Homecoming at 4. Far From Home at 3. Spider-Man 2 at 2. And Into the Spider-Verse at 1. And yeah, so far it seems like there's a fight for the one spot between Spider-Man 2 and Into the Spider-Verse amongst most of our listeners and friends on Twitter. But thank you to everybody. Stephanie is at Bunny Meow Meow on Twitter. Todd Weber is at Todd Weber Guitar. David Sunday is at Sunday Groove PTBN. Greg Russino is at Gregor Russino. Follow all these good folks. Russell is at Russell_Sellers. Follow all these good folks. They've got a lot of awesome tweets and some controversial opinions, certainly, in some situations. So thanks to all of them for submitting lists. Anyway, Nick, with that being said, we're going to take a break and come back from the other side. We've got reading and watching, and we've got the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMedation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.placemedation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMedation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Thanks once again to all of our friends on Twitter who submitted their lists of their Spider-Man rankings. Some divergences on those near the bottom of the list, but the top of the lists seemed pretty consistent. Anyway, before we move any further, we got to tell you about all the exciting things that are happening here at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. So, Nick, why don't you kick us off by talking about what's going on over on the Pop feed, which is what we're on right now. So I should have just said right here on the Pop feed.
Sure. The Sarcastic Four continue to look at 1971 with the second of their three-part episode of Marvel Age. On the 31st episode of Songs with Friends, Stephen Kelly talked Gin Blossoms and DMX. The Hard Traveling Fanboys, that's us. We're in the midst of Spider-Man month. You're listening to the episode right now. I'm not going to tease an episode you're listening to, quite frankly. DC4U continues its celebration of Superman with a look back at the pilot episode for the classic, classic in air quotes.
I'm classic gonna, TV
I'm
show.
I'm going to put
yes.
classic in air quotes. Classic nope, TV classic. Show, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. And also pay tribute to the late Eddie Jones, who yep. played Pa Kent.
Looking forward to that.
Geek and Sassy welcomed Tim Capel to recap Season 2 and preview Season 3 of Stranger Things. Meanwhile, Glenn, Scott, and their friend Alana are back with a new spectacular review of Stranger Things Season 3. So lots of Stranger Things-related content over on the Pop feed. Vote in the stupid, not stupid, it's not stupid, it's fine. Vote in the 80s song tournament. There will be 6 polls a day posted
really?
For round one. That you can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTVN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and liking the page. Be sure to weigh in.
Boy, Nick, between burying the PTVN Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and talking about how Kirsten Dunst isn't attractive enough to be a supermodel, You're really digging that hole tonight, aren't you, my friend?
Digging a hole with who?
Our audience, our listening audience.
I don't care about them. Fuck them.
Oh, will you stop?
No.
Meanwhile, over at the PTBN wrestling feed, I'm sorry, wrestling feed and sports entertainment feed, on the 11th episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben chats Evolve, ROH, and more with independent star Kurt Stallion. On episode 130 of Main Event, Scott, Nate, and Steve are joined by Sheriff Pete Schirmacher. Yes, they're talking NJPW G1 Climax, AEW, Impact, Evolve, and much more. Tim, Jenny, and me, Greg Phillips, are back with a brand new Talkin' WCW as we talk about the War Games. Had a lot of fun doing this episode with the gang. JT and Chad open up the 1996 pay-per-view year with a look at the Royal Rumble on the latest Wrestling War Zone. PTBN staff members Jennifer Smith, Drew Wardlaw, and Matt Souza gathered to break down the 1986 Crockett Cup. And finally, in the latest episode of the PTBN podcast, JT and Scott welcome Tim Slomka to the mothership as they talk the WWF Madison Square Garden house show from October 1989. Over on PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 is off and running with pieces on the Best Picture nominees for the 66th Academy Awards, the 1994 World Cup, and the miniseries The Stand. Also, the excellent network adventure team is back with a look at Black Saturday from 1984. Check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our Greatest WWE pay-per-view and TV match project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list. All right. Well, with that being said, it's time to get to our news and notes in the world of comic books. Are you ready, Nick?
I'm ready.
Are you ready for The Rundown. Well, outstanding news this week kicks us off in the world of film. Let's get right to it, because the acclaimed director of Thor Ragnarok, Taika Waititi, has officially signed on to return for Thor 4. No subtitle yet attached to said film. Nick, I know that right now you're as excited as the rest of America is about this announcement of Thor 4.
Yep.
That's all you got?
Yep.
That's all you got for me, Conrad?
Mm-hmm.
However, unfortunately, a fourth Thor film means that Warner Brothers, much anticipated by some, adaptation of the classic manga and anime Akira has been put on hold indefinitely.
Mm.
Does not appear that that movie is going to take shape anytime soon. So if you're a big fan of Akira out there, not good news in that department. You got nothing else for us, Nick?
What do you want me to say, Greg?
I just figured that this announcement would cause certain reactions in you. Would cause you to feel a certain way, but maybe it didn't. Maybe it did not inspire any strong opinions.
It caused me to roll my eyes, but other than that, you know, nothing greater than that. It was expected. I mean, this is not a great shock to anyone. Like, people liked the goofy direction of the last Thor movie. It made money, so obviously they're going to continue to go in that direction.
Yep. And you're going to continue to be the Jim Cornette of the Thor universe.
I am. And you would be the same. You would be the same way if it were a character you cared about, so it's fine. I mean, I get it. You don't care about Thor, so you think everything needs to be a joke. It's fine. I get it.
I don't care about Thor. I like Thor. Thor's a good character.
But you don't care. There, you can like a character and not really care.
That's fair.
That's my point. And if it were a character you cared about, you know, if that Jack Black Green Lantern movie had been made, you'd have bitched about that. So it's all good. That's how cookie crumbles sometimes.
Similarly, you don't care about Superman. So if they did this treatment to a Superman film, you would be all for it.
Would not give a shit. Maybe that's why I love Man of Steel so much. I don't care that they had him break somebody's neck. I just don't care.
Fair enough. What is our next story? I've lost track. Staying in the world of films. Well, not really. Staying in the world of comic book adaptations. HBO Max, we talked about last week, Nick, right here on the show. The big new streaming platform coming from Warner Brothers. After our speculation last week, it always seems to work this way, doesn't it? We talk about something as we record the show, and the next day, news breaks that addresses the very thing we were talking about. So what happened was a report came out that the HBO Max service will not affect the DC Universe streaming app, at least for now. This comes officially from Warner Brothers. They say DC Universe will not change as a result of the HBO Max app. Now, that's for now. So obviously, Nick, this could change at a moment's notice, at the whim of any executive that decides otherwise. But for now, looks like things are going to be more business as usual.
Yeah, which is good news for those of us who have become fans of what DC Universe is now offering to us. So, yeah, good news for now. But I, like you just said, I would not be surprised at all if we lose it at a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm. As we've often discussed, that Warner Brothers is the most reactionary of studios, so we'll have to see what becomes of that. Well, speaking of Warner Brothers, let's move on to the TV world on the small screen and talk about Arrowverse, because some big announcements this week, Nick. And I know that a lot of people have heard some sinus issues coming from your direction over the last few days.
Sinus issues, quite frankly.
Well, a pair of long-gone Arrow characters will make their return for the show's 8th and 9th, according to Entertainment Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready, Nick?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Josh Segarra's Adrian Chase.
Adrian Chase, yep.
And, brace yourselves, ladies and gentlemen at home, Colin Donnell's Tommy Murray. Will each appear in Arrow Season 8. Although, according to showrunner Beth Schwartz and executive producer Mark Guggenheim, mm-hmm. neither will be the character viewers remember.
Mm-hmm.
Adrian Chase comes back in a different way than expected. Obviously one of the favorite villains. And Colin is not coming back as the Tommy that we know, although they refuse to elaborate further. In another separate article, Stephen Amell mentioned that the first episode of the season is an homage to Season 1.
That's awesome. So, yeah, I would assume that the plot of the season probably involves Oliver hopping across the multiverse to put together a mm-hmm. team, much like in the original, you know, the comic Crisis on Infinite Earths. So I assume that's how we'll see Tommy and Adrian play a role.
On a level of 1 to 10, with 10 being him returning from the dead as the original Tommy Merlin, how satisfied are you with this announcement as it relates to your year's running prediction?
About a 7.
Very good. Very good. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much of your sinus passage is hurting right now after that bit?
Oh, like a 2.
Oh, that's good. That's quite good. Well, let's go to the printed page, Nick. Believe it or not, they still make these things called comics.
Hmm.
That
they're trying to get me and you to buy them lately.
I know.
The problem.
They keep teasing us with things that actually look good.
Yeah, I know.
And how dare they? Well, the first thing that looks good is the continued evolution of DC Black Label, which has really gotten a lot of announcements. It feels like in the last couple weeks since we talked about the fate of it moving forward, of course. But the big announcements for that recently include that writer Jeff Lemire is returning to DC to write 2 Black Label series this fall. The first one is called, actually I'll do these in reverse order because I want to talk about the artist of the other one, but the first one will be called The Question, The Deaths of Vic Sage, and it will feature a rotating cast of artists, artists Dennis Cowan and Bill Sienkiewicz, two of the legends of the business, really. Sienkiewicz in particular, drawing The Question, just feels like a no-brainer, Nick. Mm-hmm. This will explore a version of the Breschiller hero who dies and is reincarnated over and over again in his home of Hub City. They talk about homaging the Ditko version of The Question, and then being really able to explore the character through these different time eras and stuff like that. This looks awesome, Nick.
Oh, yeah, it does. It looks incredible. Perfect fit of creators and concept and character. I mean, this sounds amazing. I need to hold off and read it on DCU.
On DCU, yeah.
If Black Label even comes to DCU.
Right. And both of us, Nick, have talked about how The Question has been an underutilized character at DC in recent years. I think you would agree.
Yeah, for sure.
And then the other book that was announced is, stop me if you've heard this, folks, another Joker book. But,
oh, Lord.
But, here's the big hook for this one. It's called Joker Killer Smile. And the artist joining Jeff Lemire is his old partner in crime from the acclaimed New 52 Green Arrow series, Andrea Sorrentino. For my money, perhaps the best working artist in comics today. It will focus on the Joker upending the life of an Arkham mental health professional, but not Harley Quinn. Instead, a new character, Dr. Ben Arnell. And this also looks awesome.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino uniting together and doing a Joker book, that's something I'm interested in.
Them pairing together on pretty much anything
is,
you know, good enough to get me interested. So
absolutely. But that's not the only big comic book related announcement. We got another, and not even related to Batman, because there's another Batman book that is coming out, and that is an announcement that was made this week of a limited series, a 12-issue maxi series, as it's being called. And it's titled The Batman's Grave. And it is by the Authority creators, Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch. It will be about life, death, and the questions most are too afraid to ask, according to the publisher, DC Comics. And the Authority team will now take on the world's greatest detective, whose current case forces him to inhabit the mind of a murder victim with a half-eaten face, without filling the empty grave next to those of his parents. There's a few preview images of this out there now, Nick. There's a more in-depth plot summary that I recommend people to look up, an interview with Ellis and Hitch in DC's PR for this. This, we were talking this off the air, Nick. This looks like one hell of a premise for a story.
It looks amazing. Damn it. It looks so good. It makes me want to go out and buy it, which I don't want to do. I don't want any more physical comic books. I'm trying to be over that, but man, this looks awesome.
Well, I'm in the same boat with you, my friend, not just for that, but with yet more Black Label stuff, I believe, anyway. Maybe these aren't Black Label. I don't know. They don't appear to be Black Label. But the DC is unveiling a line of comics titled Tales from the Dark Multiverse. Now, Nick, we have criticized the Dark Multiverse concept. I don't think we need to rehash that again.
No.
We have. However, this looks awesome, and let me explain why. So the premise of this is that DC is putting a twist on some of the biggest, most game-changing events in the history of comics. So we're talking about stuff like the death of Superman and Nightfall, which are the two that are kicking it off. And think of it in some ways as an answer to What If.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is Tales from the Dark Multiverse.
These are essentially Elseworlds, is what they are.
Yeah, Batman Nightfall number one. This will be co-written by Scott Snyder and Kyle Higgins, with art by Javier Fernandez and a cover by Lee Weeks. It takes place in a Gotham City 30 years after a broken Bruce Wayne failed to take the mantle back of the Bat from Jean-Paul Valley. So essentially, this will take place after Night's End, but a Night's End in which Azrael defeats Bruce Wayne when he comes back to reclaim the mantle of the Bat. 30 years later, Saint Batman has turned Gotham into the city of his dreams. Killing has become commonplace, and criminals live in constant fear. But that's when a new hope arises for Gotham, the son of Bane. This sounds amazing, Nick.
Yeah, I knew that would get you excited. The tease of more Bane involvement.
More Bane involvement, more Azrael Batman as a villain, though. Color me crazy, Nick. That was the natural progression of the gosh dang character, was to make him a villain. They never did it. All right. The other one, which also holds, as you could expect, some level of appeal to me, is The Death of Superman number one, Tales from the Dark Multiverse. This one is written by writer Jeff Loveness, who I know nothing about. It says here he's from Rick and Morty, a show I've never seen, with art by Brad Walker, who I do like, and Andrew Hennessy, who I know, with a cover by Lee Weeks. In a broken world much like our own, Lois Lane, twisted by rage and grief over the Man of Steel's death, becomes the Eradicator, taking revenge on those who let Superman die and the corrupt world he could never defeat. Now with the power of a god, she's going to end the never-ending battle by any means necessary, halting the reign of the Superman before it even begins. Again, you're dealing with one of the most beloved stories of my childhood, and you're addressing questions that I always had. Whether it was Nightfall, what would have happened if Azrael had won? Now it's what happens if Lois is just broken by her grief and decides to take matters into her own hands. Very interesting concepts. Even, perhaps, more interesting are some of the other planned stories along this line, Nick. Infinite Crisis.
Yeah.
Blackest Night. The Judas Contract. All mentioned by name here. And all stories that are open to. I'm curious what the Blackest Night one could be. What if Necron had won? I don't know. That's curious.
Maybe what if somebody else got the white ring instead of?
Ooh, you know? Yeah. There's a lot of interest and intrigue in this whole deal. So, what do you make of this concept, Nick?
Sounds awesome. You know, I love these sorts of one-offs. Gonna have to avoid buying them, of course, but yeah, this sounds good.
All right. Well, with that being said, let's move on to the segment where we talk about what we've been reading and watching from the world of comics. It's that segment known as Reading and Watching. Mm. Well, Nick, I know you've been reading a lot of comics.
I have read no comics.
I have begun reading Batman The Last Knight on Earth, which is a physical comic book that I purchased because I had to kill some time in a comic book shop in Montgomery before a movie. And I thought to myself, self, I feel I owe it to this man to purchase a comic book in his store. And so I did because I thought Snyder and Capullo on Batman, I got to give it a shot. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, Nick, it's the first physical comic that isn't Doomsday Clock or Deathstroke that I've bought in some time. And I started reading it, and it's really good. I'm only about halfway through it right now, this first issue. But it's just like Snyder and Capullo never missed a beat. Their pickup, you could have picked up the last issue of their New 52 Batman run and read this right after, and it feels like a spiritual successor to that. The artwork is magnificent. Some of the recurring imagery that they had in their run is already present halfway through this book. Like, for instance, the flies buzzing around an individual I'm assuming is the Joker. Good stuff so far. Their run on Batman is so iconic that I'm excited to follow it through.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that interests me, so I'm anxious for you to finish it and get the full review at some point.
Mm-hmm. And other than that, I haven't been reading anything. And with regards to watching, I just haven't had any time to resume my Supergirl watching and catch up on it. So I haven't been watching anything on account of wrestling. Have you been watching anything?
No, I haven't.
There you have it, folks. Another riveting edition of Reading and Watching from the Hard Traveling Fanboys. You know, I'm noticing right now, Nick, over there at the on the television, mm-hmm. It's my digital television clock mm-hmm. That comes on and tells me what time it is, and it indicates to me that, by God, Nick, it's time. The wrestling minute. Well, we can't condense this into a minute, surely. We haven't in months, but. We'll see if we can keep it under 4 hours. We had a big wrestling weekend, Nick. Mm-hmm. There's no point in lying to the audience. There's no point in hiding it from the audience. We had a big weekend.
Yes, you already said that.
We went to Jacksonville, Florida.
We did.
A land of Jaguars and whatever else they have in Jacksonville, Florida. And we went there on account of All Elite Wrestling's Fight for the Fallen. However, before Fight for the Fallen, the night before, we, along with our Place to Be Nation cohort, Jennifer Smith, attended the Grilling JR Live show at the hotel in which you and I were staying. And this was a show hosted by Conrad Thompson and Jim Ross, the white meat babyface jumping Jim Ross, and featured some cameo appearances from AEW stars Joey Janela, Marco Stunt, Frankie Kazarian and Scorpio Sky. And gosh, I gotta say, Nick, this was just it blew me away, quite honestly. Like, without any kind of jokery or anything like that, it was just a great, great time. The show was amazing.
It was awesome. Well worth the money we spent. Got to meet and have our picture taken with good old JR and Conrad and hear some great stories. So mm-hmm. Time and money well spent, I would say.
100% agreed. And furthermore, the Fight for the Fallen show Saturday night was also spectacular. I mean, what a great time. First chance, obviously, that we've gotten to see AEW live. What were your impressions of it, Nick?
I enjoyed it very much. I mean, they're still working their way in terms of developing the undercard, but I think already their main event level matches are right up there with anybody in any other company mm-hmm. in the world. Kenny Omega and Shima had a hell of a performance, as did the Lucha Brothers and SCU, as did the Rhodes Brothers and the Young Bucks. So three legitimate, fantastic main event level matches that could have closed a show anywhere in the world.
Absolutely. That Kenny and Shima match was, I know you turned to me after it was over and you said, that was fucking awesome.
Yep.
it was great. So yeah.
The Kenny Omega match, I think we had been waiting for. We had yep. wanted to see in AEW. And, you know, arguably the perfect opponent to have such a match for him. You know, somebody mm-hmm. who's more familiar with a style that Kenny is comfortable working. And here's hoping that he continues to make the transition to the more Americanized style, because it's going to be interesting. Kenny Omega has never had to work the 12-minute TV match before, and that era is coming. So I'm interested to see how he adjusts to that.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the fascinating things to watch about this roster when it goes to TV, is how do they adjust to not having the leeway necessarily to work 20 to 30 minute matches every week, you know, on top. So, but I thought it was a great show. It was hot, but it was one of those deals where the show was so good that it was worth it. It was worth any mild discomfort was worth the quality of the show and the energy. That was the other thing, Nick, that I took away from it, is just how energized people are about AEW right now. It's an mm-hmm. exciting time. Obviously we had a WWE pay-per-view over the weekend as well, Extreme Rules, which I thought was a really good pay-per-view, actually. However, I know, Nick, that your entire worldview was shattered by Brock Lesnar cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase.
Yeah, man. I mean, Brock Lesnar cashing in just made me hate the show, hate WWE, and just, God, it just left such a bad taste in my mouth that the seven good matches that preceded it couldn't overcome.
And there was also an Evolve show on Saturday, which I still haven't watched all of yet. We watched a little bit of it.
We watched about roughly half, from what I understand.
Yeah, back in the hotel.
It was 2 a.m. in the morning, and Greg wanted to continue on with the show, and I had to tap out. Greg got back to the hotel and was full of energy. I should have taken the energy out of him, but I was too tired.
Yes, it was. That's how energized I was from the AEW show. Like I was fired up. I probably could have stayed up and watched the whole Evolve show that night, mm-hmm. but it was really late and you had to drive us back the next day. So,
and one more wrestling related development that we should touch on here, in the wrestling minute, a rousing game of WWE SmackDown versus Raw General Manager Mode.
People don't want to be bored by this old video game crap. We don't need to tell them about that.
It was played an entire year. Not a year's worth. We picked up an old save file we'd been working on a while back. And quite frankly, certain individuals were crushed beneath the booted heel of the superior Monday Night Raw show.
I don't know why you think this is relevant information for our listeners to have. Mistakes were made along the way. Injuries occurred. Mm-hmm. You know, there were. Listen, Nick, it's an attraction based business.
Yes, it is.
But when your lead attractions are injured, when you're
strapping yourself to the dead weight that is Bret Hart, then yes, that's the way that goes.
Oh my God. Just because I'm trying to give my audience work rate and I'm trying to give my audience mm-hmm. compelling in-ring competition every single week, and you're giving them all this sports entertainment bullshit. Maybe the audience just hasn't caught up to my more cerebral approach to the business.
I gave them Hogan and Austin, and it got 5 stars. 5 stars.
Who gave it 5 stars? That's what I want to know.
I'm assuming it was somebody.
Well, that notwithstanding, others only gave it 1.75.
Is that a 3.6 out of 10?
It's a 9 out of 43, I think, on my list of dolphins. That's what I'm ranking everything on now. My dolphin scale.
Yep.
That's right. Ironically enough, I give the Miami Dolphins about 3 dolphins. Well, with that being said, that's been the Wrestling Minute. It was a fun weekend, and energizing and enlightening. And with that being said, Nick, what do we have coming the folks' way next week?
Well, next week is our long book hunt that's going to wrap
that's
up
right.
Spider Month, when we're going to take a very special look at the classic Spider-Man story, Kraven's Last Hunt. And then in August,
neither of us have read.
And then in August, we will do something. We need to. We are running out of time. We gotta make a call on that at some point.
We work on our own schedule, nobody else's.
That's true. I think August is also technically supposed to have a certain giant size edition, ain't happening. I can go ahead and tell you right now, ain't happening.
Nope, not gonna happen. So we'll figure it out. All right. Well, with that being said, folks, I can't think of any other thing to say except thank you for tuning in. Thank you for putting up with our bullshit, and we will catch you.
Oh wait.
God, what do you got?
What are you trying to do? You know, we end the show a certain way. Been ending the show a certain way for some time now.
Well, I didn't know if he was here. I didn't see him anywhere.
Well, you don't, just because you don't see. Listen, Jim Ross, whether you see him or not, he's always around. His spirit is always with us, and so.
Especially now that we've been in contact with him.
We have.
Physical contact.
Yeah, it was good to meet him, and he was able to reaffirm his commitment to doing the show. So, here to sing another classic of the 1990s country genre, ladies and gentlemen, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross.
Well, thank you very much, guys, and I appreciate you coming out to our show, AEW Fight for the Fallen. Certainly, we're still working out a few kinks along the way. We'll figure it out, folks. We're a lot like an expansion team in the NFL or the NBA. We're figuring it out, and we're going to get there. By God, it was a lot of fun. And it was great to meet you guys, too, the host of the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. All right. Now, let's get this song started. Sorry, folks. Well, I met her. Folks, I just realized that I talk very similar to how the man who originally performed this song sang. Well, I met her out at Murphy's restaurant. She said she was fresh from the farm. I remember thinking, for a country girl, that she went pretty well armed. We sat there talking by the lobster tank. I ordered her a slow jam fizz. And when them chicken fried steaks arrived, she said, "I like living like this." So I made her the queen of my double-wide trailer with the polyester curtains and the redwood deck. Now, sometimes, you got to understand, she runs off, does a few high spots, and I got to trail her. Dang her black heart and her pretty red neck. Well, a few nights later, I run into her with some stranger on a park bench. She said, "He rebuilds engines and his name is Earl. He's the Charlie Daniels of the torque." Oh, the torque wrench. God dang it. He's the Charlie Daniels of the torque wrench. He's the Danny Hodge of the torque wrench. I whispered, "Honey, let's just go on home, have some onion rings and some JR's barbecue, and watch Mid-South TV." As I walked her to the truck, Earl was crying out loud, "Don't you leave me." So this is what I told him. I said to him, I said, "Vince, this here is the queen of my double-wide trailer with the polyester curtains and the redwood deck. Cowboy bought it. Now she's run off, and I've got to trail her. Damn her black heart and her pretty red neck. Now, bless her little soul, she's not to blame. That's just the way her mind is. If there's a way to stir trouble up, the girl was born to find. She's the queen. She is the queen, Charmel, the queen of my double-wide trailer with them polyester curtains and the redwood deck. Sometimes... just sometimes now, she runs off, and I got to trail her ass. Damn her black heart And damn her pretty red neck.
Hard Traveling Fanboys.
This is the worst podcast I've ever been on. These guys are the shits. It's true.